Blog Talk Radio. This is Love's Outer Limits, and I'm your host, Dr. Amy Marsh, sexologist, hypnotist, lots of other kinds of things, and I'm with my co-host, M. Christian, otherwise known as Chris, erotica writer, sexuality writer, sexual futurist, and also lots of all kinds of other things. We've got a great show lined up for you today, so welcome.
Well, good morning. Good morning, listeners. Good morning, Chris. How are you?
Good. How are you doing?
I'm okay. It's a little cooler. Temperature-wise. Hopefully it'll stay a little bit better than it was yesterday. And, we're just going to riff today. We're going to ramble. We're going to talk story. We're going to ignore the topic we originally thought we'd do, right? Before
exactly.
We get started... Do you want to do any shout-outs?
Let me see. Well, thank you so much. I mean, it's always wonderful that we do this. Probably the big ones, of course, is futureofsex.net, one of my all-time favorite places to write for. I also have a new article that showed up on Hot Movies. And, of course, there are other my usual suspects of Queer Majority, Kinkly, and I also have a new book out, which I've been starting to do publicity on, which is my gay erotic horror collection called Horror Sexual.
And that's so fabulous.
Information on that you can find on my website or you can find it on Twitter. And I'm doing my second and last, last is a misnomer, but the second part of my erotica writing class tomorrow for As You Like It. And the reason I sort of don't want to say it's the end is because more than likely I'll be doing classes very similar to this going forward. But for this particular series, the final one is tomorrow.
Yeah, that is so great. You're really managing to stay creative and active and really getting a lot done. That's so fabulous. I love hearing about what you're doing. Just out of curiosity, can you tell the listeners like one or two different articles that you've written for the Future of Sex lately, just so they might have some idea of something they might want to search for?
Sure, no problem whatsoever. In fact, let me do a quick little thing here, and I can tell you right off the bat, I think I've had like three or four pop up in the last week or so. I just wrote about Ross Dawson, who is the publisher of Future of Sex. He actually was interviewed for a podcast, and he also spoke to Howard Rheingold on a second broadcast. Rheingold is one of the people who's been credited with coming up with the term teledildonics. And there's also,
okay.
I did a couple of things like, you know, I wrote about like the fact that we have some new virtual backgrounds that people can spice up their Zoom, calls with. Also, the Love and Sex with Robots, which is kind of controversial, is now going online, which is not all that surprising. A couple of other ones. I'm pretty regular up there. And I think for Kinkly, I just did a couple pieces that popped up. One was on sapiosexuality. And I think the one currently up for Hot Movies is one on picking the right anal sex toy.
Okay. There you have it, listeners. So go check out M. Christian's articles. There is plenty to choose from. So that's very cool.
Anything else
you want to mention? Oh, you're welcome. Anything else you want to mention?
Not particularly right now. I'm sure I'm probably forgetting a whole bunch of things. I'm still having my second cup of coffee. And you have some wonderful things that are, brewing. I know several of your classes are going to start pretty soon.
Well, I am actually in the middle of teaching another round of a professional course, 150 hours, 15 weeks, hypnosis for sexual problems. And this is a class that's open to basically therapy, counseling, other kinds of professionals who have also had 100 hours of hypnosis training. And so this is a really intensive course. We get into a range of topics, what hypnosis can be used for, with regard to sexual concerns, sexual enrichment, also gender issues. It's all there, and it's a really fun course to teach. I've got two students in there right now, plus I'm joined by a former student, Marcos Carvalho, who I'm hoping will be a guest on the show very soon. He is a Brazilian psychologist and professor, a clinical psychologist and professor, also hypnosis trained, who is going to become the new teacher, or one of my new teachers at the Intimate Hypnosis Training Center. So I'm super excited about that. And he will be translating the course materials into Portuguese. So I'm just, you know, really, really jazzed. And then I'm still in the process of creating the final curricula for the upcoming Hypnosis for Community Wellness, which is a course that I'm really positioning within social justice and intersectionality and discussions of health disparity or health access disparity as well. And I'm granting 10 scholarships on people who have an interest in this, and mostly activists with an emphasis on Black, Indigenous, and people of color, LGBTQIA plus activists, social justice activists, you know, people who are really going to be getting out there in their community and bringing some of these skills for wellness. So that's huge. And
that's very big. That's wonderful. Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you. Yeah. And I'm not sure if I mentioned this last week, but a interview that I was interviewed by a fantastic YouTube sexologist who is also a serious therapist with a practice, Carlos. His YouTube channel asked Carlos. I was interviewed for his erotic hypnosis video. So that's up on YouTube right now, so you could find that. So yeah, those are kind of the fun things that are happening here.
And you also did an AMA with Shakuna Tickle Life, too.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. That was a lot of fun. And I went into it knowing or not knowing what the initials AMA would stand for. Now I know, thanks to you, that it stands for Ask Me Anything. And people did ask questions, and I was having fun answering them. It was great. I love spending time with Shakun, and she's also going to be back on our show, I think on July 16th, 11th, I forget, whatever the Saturday is. That's the second Saturday in the month of July. So yeah, good stuff going on. I've got some things I want to talk about. I'm sure you have some things
Sure. You
want to talk about. What do we want to start with first?
Now, why don't you go ahead and get revved up while I finish my coffee?
Okay, well, I am on my second cup of tea. And yeah, so I started my morning in an interesting way.
Oh?
Well, sorry, that pause there was me having a sip of tea. My voice, for some reason, feels a little hoarse. Yeah, I decided to just go full tilt, fan girl, fan crone, actually, since I'm of that age, over the series on Netflix called The Untamed. So this is a sprawling epic, 50 episodes, and it's just phenomenal, and I'm now about halfway into my second, you know, binge watch of this series, and I want to read you. I mean, it's gorgeous. It's a Chinese drama of magic and clan rivalry and all kinds of things, but at the heart of it is this lovely queer romance that had to be very carefully conveyed because Chinese censorship is so strict. But it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. The people are beautiful. The sets are beautiful. There's humor. There's tenderness. There's a super mischievous character, Wei Wuxian. I'm probably mispronouncing it, but there's the trickster character and there's the ice prince, and their chemistry is almost intolerably wonderful. I have so much fun watching it, and it's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant. A writer on Vox, well, let's see, who's the writer? I'll do a link to this in the show notes, but a writer named Aja Romano wrote a review on Vox on March 27, 2020, and it's called The Untamed, streaming on Netflix, ripped my heart out and said it to me, I can't get enough.
Aww.
And the subtitle is Come for Queer Soulmates, Stay for Epic Fantasy, Families, Demon Flutes, and Love Triumphing Amid Censorship. And I believe yesterday was actually the anniversary of when the show started airing on Netflix. I don't know why I didn't pick up on it sooner, but I'm just having the most fun of my life. Really helps to watch it a second time because some of the characters have several different names. The cast is huge. It's a little easier to keep track of some of the plot, you know, subplots now that I'm on the second thing. So big, big endorsement, big, happy sexologist hearts going out to The Untamed and all the people in the cast, and especially the two stars who are both in kind of pop boy bands back in China. They're just brilliant people, really great actors. And I love that. I'm going to stop going off on this in just a minute, but there's
no, please go ahead.
Hilarious line about, excuse me. So Wan Ji is the ice prince, as one reviewer called him. And I love this one sentence or two sentences. It says, so Wan Ji, so that's the character, exudes soul-spilling longing, which Wang Yibo, who's the actor, conveys primarily through mesmerizing, infinitesimal facial adjustments that somehow contain grand canyons of emotional depth that will leave you clawing the floor. It's like watching an inflamed Victorian melodrama, except instead of north and south, it's 50 hours of Wan Ji pledging eternal love to Wei Wuxian with the smallest curve of his mouth. And it is amazing to watch what this actor does with, as the writer said, infinitesimal facial adjustments. It's so darn good, I swear. So anyway, you know, listeners, like, get on it, okay? You'll have a good time. And if you don't tell me, because I don't want to know you. So, all right. Over to you, Chris. What have you got on your podcast plate?
Well, I've been kind of like jumping all over the place when it came to entertainment. I finally settled down, and I'm watching all the Marvel movies. Which I almost want to write Marvel, and I know, you know, like Perlmutter, who the CEO is a deplorable human being, but I just think that we need more Marvel movies. We need them to get off their butts and make us more Marvel movies because they're fun, they're exciting, and they're we need heroes right now. We need selfless and intelligent and, you know, caring heroes. And so I'm like, I just finished Winter Soldier. I'll go over to one of my all-time favorites, which is the first of the Guardians of the Galaxy movies. I particularly want to give a shout-out for the return of one of my favorite series, which is the TV adaptation of the Doom Patrol comics. The first season is up. You can take a look at that, and I highly recommend it. It's surreal in a way that is, like, remarkably surreal. I mean, I'm not going to go into it because it's really convoluted and crazy and wonderful, but it's got everything from one of the lead characters is queer to a gender-fluid sentient street. It's got drag performances. It's really magnificent. A lot of it's based on the comic work of Grant Morrison, And I have to say that even though I'm not a big fan of, you know, people who adapt other, you know, things, you know, one medium to another, they've done a really excellent job. And it's got wonderful actors. I really highly recommend it. So that's definitely one to check out as well. I've also been grooving. I just finished it, unfortunately. Kiku and the Wonder Beasts on Netflix, which is an animated show. Again, just wonderful, you know, inclusive characters, really well written, excellently animated. I really highly recommend that one as well.
Sounds good. So, Speaking of the Marvel movies, of course, you know that I'm, as a serious devotee of the Norse Loki, that I'm also a Tom Hiddleston Loki fan, because, you know, I see that as a legitimate vehicle for my favorite deity to be able to work as well upon the, you know, Midgardians, so to speak. But I found it very interesting when I was looking at the costuming for the Untamed to see how much that kind of costume influenced the costuming for Loki when he's in his full regalia in the Marvel movie.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, you know, I did pick up on the Asian influence of sort of the cut and the flow of these, you know, garments that he wears, but it seemed to have a lot in common with what I was seeing over there. So just an interesting side note. Yeah.
He's wonderful. Yeah. He's actually one of my all-time favorite characters in all the movies. I mean, I'm so glad he's coming back for the new TV series, which I understand is already in development over at Disney Plus, and hopefully it'll air fairly soon, because I really like the idea of him, like, because last we saw him, he had stolen, I think, the Tesseract and zapped himself back in time, and that's what the series is kind of based on.
Okay, yeah, that will be fun to watch. I am also waiting for that, too. I do like eye candy, and I got to admit that Hiddleston's Loki is definitely an eye candy situation for me. So let's see. So we've covered entertainment. We've covered some of our favorite obsessions, or at least some of my favorite obsessions. What else have we got here on our podcast plate?
I don't know. It's just so wonderful to talk to you. And you know, it's funny because we had just talked last night about the reason why we wanted to kind of sidestep this, you know, the discussion we originally advertised, which was on erotica, you know, and such. And I think we both had an interesting kind of takeaway from it that, you know, it's like classic erotica is, you know, can be really good, but also rather problematic. And frankly, it's like, you know, it's funny. It's like, even though I write it and I edit it and I'm a publisher, I don't read a lot of erotica recreationally. It's just not my favorite genre, which I think is rather odd, but part of it's because I find a lot of it really kind of derivative. I mean, there's some that have done a good job, but you know, for the most part, it's like, it doesn't really measure up sometimes.
Yeah. And it's interesting that we're talking about that. Yeah, when I originally thought of that as a show episode, or I don't know, we both thought, whoever, I thought, well, I could dig out some of my old vintage erotology, which, frankly, I'm not that interested in for a lot of the reasons that you just said. But I thought, well, from a sort of historical erotology viewpoint, you know, we could have a show about that. But I don't find it that interesting. It's boring.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly what, at least what I've got on my shelf in these sort of vintage volumes, is Victorian and Edwardian era, use the word era, that's interesting, era, you know, heterosexual, cisgender stuff, and I don't know, I don't even want to talk about it. So I was so glad when I found that you were also very lukewarm on the idea. So yeah, that one goes in the trash heap. We're not going to do that right now. I don't know. When I went to school at the Institute for Advanced Study of Human Sexuality, we had a whole section of our training was devoted to erotology. So we watched movies, we looked at books, we looked at comic books, we listened to body limericks. I mean, we were supposed to get kind of a We looked at visual art. We were supposed to get a kind of a historic overview of at least some, mostly European and American productions of various kinds. But it wasn't, oh yeah, and there was a gay erotica course that was fun. I took that from the wonderful Jerry Zantera, Dr. Jerry Zantera, who's, you know, an amazing teacher. But basically, there was not that much of a context or critique. You know, it's just sort of like, here, look at this, listen to that, et cetera. Here, have some movie one-sheet posters from the 70s. I mean, how many times had I been offered a one-sheet of Hot and Saucy Pizza Girls? I mean, really? Like, please, no. But that was just part of being at the Institute. Every now and then, the founder, who shall not be named, would go into the vault and pull out a stack of one sheets that I think he'd probably gotten from the Mitchell brothers when they were still around, and start passing them out like candy. I don't know. I've got some of that stuff. I can't even give it away right now. I wish I could. I don't really want it. But yeah, so here I am, a sexologist going, meh. And here you are, an erotic writer, also kind of going, meh. But it's meh about certain things, right? I don't know. So yeah, there just seems to be more interesting things to talk about. Yes,
Or I completely agree. I completely agree.
So,
well, funny you mentioned about the erotic art, because I'm not a big fan of the literature per se, though I do like the really classics. And as we talked about last time, I'm not a huge fan of Annie Nin. I don't find her stories all that really, they don't really, you know, get to me, so to speak. But, you know, I've also been a big fan of, like, what we consider vintage erotica, because first of all, they it's before the age of, like, if you look at, I mean, it's weird when you look at the state of adult entertainment right now. It's kind of like, it kind of split, because you have like the, you know, almost androidish, you know, buffed and toned performers that frankly all look exactly alike. And then you've got the amateurs on the other side that are much more about real people. And that's always why I found the allure about vintage stuff, is because they look like people. They didn't look like these, you know, androids that are mass produced. And sometimes they're really quite unique. I particularly like the fact that I have a book on erotic cinema, and they talked about like how certain types of blue movies, and we're talking like maybe 30s, 40s, and 50s, you know, how the culture where the film was produced reflected a certain aspect of sexuality, like, you know, BDSM, corporal punishment and such, was very popular in Great Britain, and Italy and Spain, priests and nuns showed up, you know, with a remarkable frequency.
That doesn't sound so remarkable, actually. Yeah, but that makes sense. There was a teacher at the Institute. I'm blanking on her name now. She's no longer alive. But she talked about assessing cultures for either sexually repressed, sexually supportive and knowledgeable, or sexually conflicted. And I think that we can also use those sorts of categories to assess erotic productions, whether it's movies, art, literature, you know, body limericks, whatever, to kind of see if the works were created either in accordance and resonating with a certain culture or maybe subculture, or if they were created kind of in opposition to that culture. And these are some of the ways that you could make it interesting, even reviewing the boring stuff, you know, pull that kind of intellectual critique into it. But I think the other thing too, the quaintness factor of vintage erotic literature, say, as opposed to the images. Now so many things that were thought to be, you know, naughty and wicked and forbidden are really taken as a matter of course, at least in the United States. course, there are other places that have very strict censorship and laws, even death penalties for certain things that we accept here in the U.S. I hope we never go backwards. We do seem to slide backwards, but I hope we never go that far. I don't know. I've had enough of pontificating on that topic.
Well, I think it's interesting. I think the reason it's funny because, I mean, again, I'm not a sociologist and I'm just kind of an armchair one. But one thing I think I've noted is, you know, it's interesting how censorship used to be much more prevalent. It used to be a really serious concern, and many people, you know, went to jail over it, and some people are still prosecuted today. But I think the internet has pretty much made that impossible. I mean, yes, you have certain countries like China, and I believe it's Iran, will just simply block the internet completely, or, you know, keep certain sites from appearing when you're in that country. But by and large, these days, trying to enforce any kind of censorship is pretty much impossible. Though I do think it is necessary when it's things that are done non-consensually. Absolutely.
Of course.
But at the same time, it's pretty much almost impossible. I mean, the ease we can transmit, you know, text and information and such these days is trying to control it is really problematic. But yeah, I mean, it used to be where, certain codes would come into place. I mean, typically, before I moved on to something else, I think this is a really interesting story, and I have to apologize if this is apocryphal, but this is what I heard is, you know, when you look at Japanese erotic content, particularly visual, which is often given the term hentai, which is not quite accurate, but we're not going to go down that road. Tentacles show up all the time. And for a long time, people thought, oh, you know, the Japanese have a thing for tentacles. And while there is evidence of, like, Edo period, you know, erotic images, Hakusai did a very famous one of a woman being ravished by an octopus, the majority reason why tentacles are prevalent because of Japanese censorship codes didn't allow the actual use of a penis. So if you can't show a penis, what do you show? Tentacle.
Interesting. Okay. Which is quite a contrast from the earlier shunga, the very explicit and often using absolutely gigantic representations of penises to kind of convey the amount of desire that somebody's feeling in the picture. So when do you think those, do you have a sense of when the censorship came into Japan?
Well, what I've heard was a large part of it was due to the new Japanese constitution that General MacArthur kind of helped create. So after the war, it was very, you know, they had things put in there about, you know, explicit imagery, and that was a big part of it. So I think that was a major factor right there, which is interesting because Western culture and Western values kind of interrupting what, you know, another, you know, society's rules around sexuality. That's as far as I know. Again, I'm not an expert, but that's what I have heard. It's also interesting when you look at certain, like, common sexual tropes. I mean, just picking on the Japanese again, like, for instance, the nosebleed. If you watch enough anime, you'll see someone who, like, will get a flash of boobies or whatever, and their nose will suddenly erupt. And that's funny because, like, it doesn't exist in real life, but it's become this kind of trope to, like you mentioned before, reflecting arousal.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, and that's interesting, this whole nosebleed thing, because I've been trying to figure out nosebleeds in American TV series, which tends to signify you're going to die now. And I haven't figured out why the nosebleed signifies that, except, of course, it's an easy visual. But it's just kind of, you know, it's like one day I'm watching things and there's no nosebleeds, and then now all of a sudden everybody's got nosebleeds. But that's a different, it's definitely not being used for arousal in that way. So interesting, very interesting. So you could get really confused. I'm going to have to remember this. I don't know. Oh God, it's getting hot here. I'm melting. My beautiful wickedness is melting. Everything is going here. I'm moaning. It's no fun. I have never been so miserable on a podcast before. I'm going to let everybody know about it.
Spray yourself with cold water and keep some ice around. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, where I am, it's hot, but not compared to where you are. That's something. It's like now suddenly, you know, we've had to deal with the corona pandemic, and then there's, you know, what I think, again, one of the wonderful, you know, the protests that are taking place. And now we have record high temperatures. So we got climate change, pandemic, and, you know, massive social change, or what hopefully will become massive social change. So we're living, like you mentioned before, we're really living in interesting times.
We really are. I'll tell you, though, the last couple of days with the heat wave here, where I am in California, I'm realizing that we're probably going to have to start digging deep into the ground and construct cooling rooms for people in houses, or we're going to have to start building our cities underground, because if this heat keeps up, and who knows what we're going to do for the animals and the plants, my goodness, but plant more trees. Okay. If we could plant a whole lot more trees, we'd be okay. But cellars, you know, insulated with lots of dirt on top of and around where you're hiding from the sun. This is the future, definitely.
I do think sometimes it's interesting to think about how moving forward things are going to be irreparably altered. I mean, we have it on three fronts right now. We have, of course, the coronavirus, you know, lockdown, the epidemic, mask wearing, and then we have the social protests, which I'm so glad we're seeing, you know, at least the signs of people are really taking this much, you know, really seriously and really activating, I mean, being activistic towards, like, making some really meaningful changes. And then you got, like, climate change on top of that. So it's like, it used to be that, you know, the future was always very unpredictable. Now it's even more so. I mean, many of these things we won't even see or probably even be aware of the changes until they're here. I mean, who would have thought that, you know, what, 6-7 months ago we would be living in this kind of situation? And it's just like, it seems like every day there's some kind of, like, you know, major, you know, upheaval, sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse. But, you know, I've always been fascinated by how this is going to change. I mean, we're already seeing things like a massive surge in the popularity of connected sex toys. And, you know, there's even like a kind of thing now where people are starting to sexualize, you know, face masks. And then, like you mentioned, you know, climate change and low environmental impact housing, you know, will hopefully start to pick up. And I think I just read something really fascinating the other day, and this is something I've always kind of thought was going to happen eventually anyway, but they're starting to make noises now that even after the pandemic is lifted, people will not want to go into work physically, because now they've gotten used to working from home, and businesses have started to realize they don't need to actually have physical bodies and chairs. So this could affect all kinds of things, including family dynamics. It could affect, you know, climate change again, because people won't be traveling as much. But also it'll affect how cities are constructed, because you don't no longer have to live anywhere close to a major city to have a job. You can live anywhere. So I'm really curious how that's going to affect, like, how cities are constructed, you know, how people live their lives. It's really quite fascinating.
Well, there is going to be a lot of adjustment made, but obviously we have to keep remembering that there are whole segments of the workforce where people are still going to have to go to their jobs. I mean, you know, the work from home thing really only covers people who are doing office jobs and tech. And people who are doing cottage industry, you know, I can make my, you know, beeswax candles at home and sell them through Etsy. But otherwise, we're going to have still tons of people, usually people who are not paid very well, having to go to work. And as they are now, not getting well paid, working in conditions where they're not safe, there isn't proximity, maybe there's a culture in the workplace where you're discouraged from wearing a mask, or the people around you don't want to wear a mask. I mean, there's a whole, if we're not careful, we're going to have even more of an underclass in jeopardy without good health care and without good workplace protection. So, I mean, while we can look at, you know, the real advantages to working from home, you know, which is something both you and I do, I really don't want us to forget the other people who are super essential to those of us who work at home, like people picking the produce, people packing the produce, people working in the grocery store, people, you know, doing a lot of that stuff that, you know what I'm saying? We can't forget them.
I know exactly what you're saying, and I completely agree with you. One thing I think that's also interesting, which connects exactly what you're talking about, is the farm workers union went on strike. You know, once again, because of unsafe conditions, because they're not being paid their what they're due. I think that's really important. I think, you know, hopefully emboldened by the current other protests, we're going to see a lot more activism in all fronts. And, you know, these people who are really putting themselves on the front line and keeping our society running, they need to be treated as what they are, which is heroes. They need to be, you know, rewarded, they need to be supported, and they need to be recognized. And I know that several states and cities have actually put forth, you know, the idea and even implemented that they receive hazard pay. And so, I mean, you know, we need to shift our societal focus away from, you know, celebrating these people who are, you know, not really contributing anything, and the people who are actually, you know, maintaining everything. And so I completely agree with you. And again, it's an example of hopefully what, you know, we'll take this opportunity to actually change so much of our society that has, you know, been built on the back of people who are just poorly treated, poorly paid, and, you know, given no voice.
Absolutely. Yeah. So was that the United Farm Workers Union went on strike? Somehow
I
missed that news. Cool.
I believe so.
Right. Great.
You know, another side effect is also education. You know, because I just read recently another thing where many of the big, you know, colleges, which I always have a very big problem with, because, again, it's, you know, only if you're rich and connected can you get the quality education. A lot of them are starting to realize that they really can't go back to the way things were. So they're considering a large, you know, turnover to more virtual education, which makes a lot more sense. You can reach more people. It's more cost effective. And again, it's like, you know, part of the reason these universities charge so much is because they have properties maintained and, you know, students to house and all this kind of stuff. Remove that from the equation, they don't really have a reason for charging as much as they do.
Yeah, and that's going to have an interesting effect too on how these universities fundraise. Because so much of the time they're fundraising for capital campaigns to either build or renovate their physical properties. Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Not everybody is wild about online education. I happen to be a fan, but that's because I have a disability that makes it difficult for me to go out in public and breathe other people's perfume. So online education has been super, super helpful for me. But I know there are other people who have different kinds of needs or maybe don't learn as well using a keyboard and a screen. You know, maybe there's certainly things to learn that are not written or visual. There's a lot to learn that, you know, say arts programs, you want to do things with your hands. So, you know, again, there's going to be a lot going on. We're going to have to rethink everything. We know that. And we're certainly in the process of trying to rethink sex, as we know, and intimacy, and how all that's going to work, and dating, and how are people going to do that. We've talked about it, but I think there's going to be so much more to say. I was hearing something whooshing there. What was that? That was
probably me just adjusting myself in my chair.
It was more like a white noise whoosh. Anyway, you know me, I'm distracted by sounds. Let's see. Oh,
but
my gosh.
Sex, I think this is something that definitely is worth, you know, talking more about, because, I mean, you know, I just, you know, Tristan Taramino, you know, and I was in a Savage Love column, and she basically said that polyamory right now is basically on hold. So that's another aspect, because people can't really go out there and meet people in person, though I have heard that that's still happening, and it's just simply moved to a virtual arena. Though I also just read a post today that said that there's also there's a lot of concerns. I don't think concerns aren't the right word, because frankly I think it's a little alarmist, but the idea that, you know, meeting someone virtually and then meeting them in person can be kind of a letdown, which I don't really understand the logic on that one, but it is something, you know, kind of consider. I also wonder if after being in lockdown for, you know, which could possibly last for the rest of the year, even beyond, how that might affect, like, intimacy. So, you know, it might be hard to, you know, emotionally reconnect with, you know, after spending so much time isolated with other people. So that's another factor. I also think emotional is going to be interesting. I find myself also, like, you know, because I live alone, like yourself, it's like, you know, I don't have anybody else to sort of, like, be intimate with or to, like, even share space with. And I find myself, one of the few times I go out to get groceries, having an odd emotional reaction to just communicating or being, you know, in proximity to other real people.
I know, it's weird, isn't it? It really is strange. I think our feelings about, I don't know, personal space has gotten shifted somehow. We now have to view everybody as a potential danger in a way that we didn't. Though I have to say, I'm going to take that back, because clearly there's groups of people, again, in this country, who have always had to view certain types of other people as potential danger.
Absolutely.
You know, for various reasons. But now we've got the COVID-19 on top of that. And it just makes it odd. It makes it really, really odd. You know, I forgot that we should probably do an invitation to people to call in if they like. So I'm going to just say, here's our number. If there's anybody listening who wants to call in and make some comments, the number is 516-531-9238. If you want to give us a call, we've got about slightly over 15 minutes more in the show. And so if you'd like to have your say, ask a question, we're here once again at 516-531-9238. Nobody's called yet. I have this little screen that I look at that's kind of my on-the-air studio, and I can see if somebody happens to ring in. And that's okay. You know, one day we'll get a call from somebody out there. But if you're tempted, now's your time. You could talk with two desperately isolated people. I'm sorry. Maybe you're not desperate, but sometimes I feel that I am. Desperately isolated here. So, gosh.
That's the other thing. It's like this whole situation has caused, like, I mean, you know, just pick one of these various, you know, things we've talked about. And it's like, I'd like to see more mental health professionals speaking up a little bit, because even though we're talking about things like social distancing, wearing a mask, you know, the importance of maintaining the protest momentum, you know, climate change and the impact, we also need to start talking about the emotional toll this is having on people, and not just stress. I mean, loneliness, depression, you know, a lot of levels of anxiety. I mean, it's like, you know, we've never been so uncertain as a culture. What's going to happen. And, you know, I find myself particularly like going through bouts of severe depression and anxiety. And I count myself fortunate that, you know, like you mentioned before, it's like I'm already sort of used to social isolation, being kind of a hermit and a writer, but also being self-employed. I'm used to, like, that's where my income comes from. But, you know, just imagining what this must be like to people who have to go out or whose job has been, you know, lost, or, you know, family members, you know, trapped at home with family members, or trapped away from family members. I mean, it's just the level of anxiety around this must be phenomenal. And that's, unfortunately, I wish people would talk more about.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And I am sorry, you know, that you're going through what you're going through. And I know you're not alone. And, you know, back, several months ago, it was definitely in might have even been around 2000, the end of 2018 or sometime in 2019. I did a couple of shows called Lonely in Lake County, which is where I live, Lake County, California. And I was talking about all the research that's come out showing that loneliness can be as detrimental to your health as 15 cigarettes a day. I mean, it has that much of an impact on your health. And that's striking. You know, it's very, very striking. And now, of course, I'm sure that's all just exacerbated like crazy, you know, and that we're going to find once we get through the pandemic, we're going to find ourselves dealing with health problems that we'll find are related to the loneliness and the stress of being in isolation. It's you're right. There should be more help offered. I think a lot of mental health professionals are speaking out, but it's not so much speaking out as one thing, but being able to have a lot of services in place, especially for people who are low income, and also for people who feel that there's some sort of stigma for getting in touch with a mental health person. You know, it's the one good thing I would say that online telehealth services are actually shown to be just as effective as in-person counseling sessions or therapy sessions. So you're not getting substandard care. And some of the advantages are that if you do come from a family or a culture, or you just have personal stigma against the idea of going to see somebody and getting mental health and emotional health, the fact that you don't have to travel outside and put your car in a parking lot and go into a building that's identified as being a psychotherapist's office can actually be helpful for people. And they've also found that young adults and teenagers are happy getting therapy via text. They don't even necessarily need to talk to, but texting can actually be part of the it can actually be helpful, which kind of blows me away, really, but I guess I can see that. So a lot of people have gone, actually probably most people in private practice have gone to some form of telehealth and offer it, but that still doesn't mean that it's accessible enough for a whole lot of people.
And another important aspect, too, is the fact that, you know, when you, you know, if you need a specific kind of, you know, health care, mental and physical, you know, the fact of the matter is you're limited by your options, by your location, but not anymore. So if you're looking for a therapist who specializes in a particular type of therapy or deals with certain types of, you know, mental health concerns, you don't have to worry, you know, oh, my God, I can't reach them because they're in a different state or a different country. Now it's just like there is no distance anymore. So you can get the specific help you need. But I do think it's like reaching out as part of that. And I do, I have to say that, you know, I'm so glad that, you know, we're seeing, you know, many people are doing this. I think the fallback, though, or at least the drawback, I should say, is that, you know, people who have already been in therapy now know how to get it. But people who have maybe not have experienced this level of stress or anxiety, then they definitely need to be reassured that it's perfectly normal. Reaching out for help, getting help is something that you should really consider doing. But you know, I do think it's interesting how the telehealth thing is really remarkable. I mean, I don't really see any reason to go into my doctor's. I mean, every once in a while I need to go into something else, but mostly I've been doing it over the phone.
Yeah, and that's great. I've been doing the same, and that's working well for me right now. The thing I wanted to bring up, actually, before I forget it, is there are hotlines, there are warm lines, there are national phone lines you can call, there are local phone lines you can call. In many areas, if you dial 211, that'll be a portal for you into your area's mental health provider system. So you can get emergency help. You can get somebody to just talk to. I trained and volunteered on a crisis line in Alameda County for a while. I got about 70 hours in. And And in that particular line, people were able to call up to, I think, three times a day if they needed to. And the focus was on helping people work out their own ideas for self-care to get them through, you know, the next hour or two of their life, or the next, you know, or that day. So there are short-term conversations about short-term things people could do to feel better right now, and help people to remember that they have some options. And so you're going to find, you know, there are people available, there are people volunteering. Most of the people on the crisis lines now are probably volunteering from home instead of going to the crisis center to do that. But there is help available, at least in the short term, and immediately if you call a crisis line. And so I don't know. I should probably put a few of those in the show notes, you know, when we end this episode. And I'm going to say again, our guest call-in number is 516-531-9238, in case you have a question or you want to make some comments, if you're out there listeners. Okay. Yeah, that was a really good point about mental and emotional health. So thank you for that. Let's see, what else?
I do think it's one of those things. I'm sorry?
Oh, I was going to say what else, but we can keep going on this one.
Well, I think once again, I think it's always worth reporting is that, you know, that you're not alone, that there are services out there and there are people out there who care about you. And it's perfectly reasonable to be stressed and depressed and anxious around all this. It is really a very scary time. And I think, you know, more than anything, we need to take time also to be kind to one another, to really like not allow our anxiety and our stress to negatively affect, you know, not just ourselves, but everyone we care about, even reaching out online. I mean, it's scary. A lot of people are really having a very hard time processing this. And part of it, I do have to give another call out to, is, you know, to don't allow fear and misinformation to make the situation worse. There's a lot of people, including our, you know, anyway, the Mango Mussolini, who has made this situation intolerably worse. Instead, find, you know, actual scientific resources, the World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, you know, organizations such as that, as far as coronavirus, as far as like mental health services, the same exact thing. It's like, you know, and even around the protests, you know, find the real information. Don't fall for propaganda. Don't fall for fear mongering. You know, we will, as a society, you know, get through this, and who knows, maybe on the other end we'll be better for it, because I think this is something that has forced us to really deal and face a lot of problems in our society that has, you know, harmed and killed so many people for just who they are, and that needs to stop. And now's the time to turn that into activism and self-care.
Absolutely, yeah. And, you know, one of the things that is so discouraging, and I just watched a video on Twitter today of a number of police officers inside, I don't know if it was a deli or a donut shop or what, but on the windows, it's like you can't come inside unless you're wearing a mask. But there was a whole stream of like 6, 7, or 8 different people, police officers, not wearing a mask in there ordering their food. The people behind the counter were wearing the mask. And I just, you know, I think that there has to be more attention paid by these people who are supposed to be looking out for our safety, and we're knowing that a lot of times they're not. But if you're one of those people in that first responder category and you want to look like the good guy and be the good guy, whatever gender you are, wear a mask. Wear a mask. I just don't understand. And for heaven's sakes, don't tear the mask off of somebody's face if you're interrogating them either. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is, it's just so hard for me to fathom, I've got to say. And I didn't mean to end the show on a tirade, but
no.
Come on, you know, it's unforgivable, really. It really is. So, yeah.
Well, you brought up something the other night that I think it's also important is, while it's critical to call people out for irresponsible behavior, it's also important to reward and support, you know, businesses that are insisting on people wear masks, that governors and mayors who are insisting, people who are making the right decision. I mean, and there's a certain degree where you have to call out bad behavior, but you also have to reward good behavior. And, you know, very many times when I've talked to people, particularly like, you know, here in Oregon, they have a hotline for corona issues and so forth. It's like, I make a big point of saying, you know, you guys are doing the good work, and then you need to hear more, you know, than you probably receive, that you are really trying your best and doing a great job. The same is true of stores. The same is true of activists. The same is true of all over the place. It's like, we need to make this, you know, not just a negative, but also, you know, say you're out there doing the fight. You're the ones who are taking the risks and, you know, standing up for this irresponsible behavior. That takes a large amount of bravery.
Well, it does. Yeah. Here in my county, some of us got together and created a little fund so that every Friday we do what we call a money bomb to a business that's actually doing really well, insisting on upholding the health precautions. But can you imagine being one of those businesses that wants to uphold that, but being visited by one, two, three, or more first responders who come in without wearing the mask? And there's that power, you know, differential there, where you don't want to piss off the officer by saying, hey, you know, you've really got to put your mask on before you come in here. And so I, the unfairness of it, forcing people to suck it up even when they want to be good with the health regulations, that made me angry. But I agree with you. Giving praise to your public health officials, praise to your businesses, praise to first responders, people that are actually doing it in the right way. Absolutely important. They need that encouragement, because the opposition to upholding the health precautions isn't sometimes so virulent. It's amazing. It's so vicious. But on that happy note, do you have something light and bright for the last couple of minutes in the show, or should we just stop now and we'll have All About Clowns and Coulrophilia next week? So.
Oh, that'll be fun. But, you know, definitely, you know, find a good show to watch, you know, take up a hobby, you know, sleep as much as you can. And once again, it's like, you know, just be, you know, I know it's going to be challenging, but staying, you know, positive and staying healthy, both physically and mentally, is so important right now.
It really is. Yes. Okay. Well, listeners, we will be with you again next week. I hope you'll be with us. And Chris, thanks again for yet another lovely podcast chat, and we'll be talking soon. So,
absolutely. Thank you so much.
Oh, yeah. You're welcome. All right. Take care, everybody. Have a great week and weekend.